Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English. On today's program, you will hear stories from Brian Lynn, Alice Bryant, and John Russell. We end our program with another episode of The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Brian Lynn.
Myanmar's top court rejected Tuesday the final appeal of two Reuters journalists jailed while working on an investigation into the killing of 10 Rohingya Muslim men and boys. The Supreme Court's decision upheld seven-year prison sentences for Wa Lone and Cha So U. The court did not give a reason for its ruling, which was quickly condemned by rights groups. The two reporters were arrested in December 2017 and sentenced last September. They were charged with illegally possessing official documents. The documents related to security operations taking place in the western state of Rakhine. In August 2017, suspected Rohingya militants launched attacks against state security forces in Rakhine. In answer, government troops carried out attacks against the rebels and their supporters. About 700,000 Rohingya fled the area to escape the violence. Most are now living in refugee camps in neighboring Bangladesh. The United Nations has described the Myanmar military operation as a well-organized example of ethnic cleansing. Myanmar officials have denied the military carried out human rights abuses. It said the campaign was necessary to defend against attacks by Rohingya militants. The chief legal officer for Reuters, Gail Gove, reacted to the court's rejection of the appeal. Wa Lone and Cha So U did not commit any crime, nor was there any proof that they did, Gove said. She added, instead, they were victims of a police setup to silence their truthful reporting. We will continue to do all we can to free them as soon as possible. Phil Robertson is the Deputy Asia Director for New York-based Human Rights Watch. He repeated the organization's opposition to the legal actions against the two reporters, who, in his words, were just doing their jobs as investigative journalists. Sadly, when it comes to media freedom, both Myanmar's military and the civilian government seem equally determined to extinguish any ability to question their misrule and rights violations, Robertson said. The two were not present for Tuesday's decision, but their wives were. Cha So U's wife, Chit Su, broke down in tears when the ruling was read. Both he and I hoped for the best, she told reporters. I am terribly sad for this decision. A lawyer for the two journalists in Myanmar said the pair could still seek their freedom by appealing directly to the president's office or Myanmar's legislature. The president could reduce the sentence, order a retrial, or have the two men released. Legislative action would require a longer, more complex process. Rights groups have urged Myanmar's civilian leader, Aung San Suu Kyi, to use her influence to intervene in the case. But so far, she has not done so. The investigation the journalists were working on was completed by other Reuters employees and published in 2018. The coverage was recently awarded the Pulitzer Prize for International Reporting. I'm Brian Lin.
The fire at Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris has raised questions about the condition of thousands of other cathedrals and historic structures across Europe. It also raises questions about whether European governments are doing enough to keep up and care for such buildings. Critics suggest that a culture of indifference to aging world-famous buildings could undermine a shared history and Europe's tourism industry. Tibor Navracsics is the European Union's top culture official. He told the Associated Press that we are so used to our outstanding cultural heritage in Europe that we tend to forget that it needs constant care and attention. Some people say the fire last week was a wake-up call, not just for Europe, but the whole world. Sneska Kwadvilig Mihailovic heads the heritage group Europa Nostra. She said it was as if Notre Dame decided to set itself on fire to ring the alarm bell, as if she wanted to sacrifice herself for the cause.
Large fires have long robbed humanity of knowledge, art, and treasures. One example is the fire at the famous Library of Alexandria in northern Egypt. Didier Riechner works for the French magazine La Tribune de l'Art. Riechner knows of no actual list of historic buildings destroyed by fire. But he added that France sees several fires every year in historic buildings, which is already way too much. In 2015, the German engineering company Siemens found that Scotland had about 10 damaging fires a year, while England lost at least a dozen listed buildings a year. In Germany, 70 historic buildings have been destroyed since 2000. And all too often, fires happen while old structures are being repaired. The Glasgow School of Art's McIntosh building, for example, was heavily damaged by fire last year. It was the second large fire in 4 years as workers neared the end of a multi-million-dollar restoration project.
Experts say that what is needed is continuous attention and maintenance. These steps, if taken, could help avoid the need for major restoration work. But regular attention and maintenance costs money. Part of the problem comes from austerity budgets approved by governments after the 2008 financial crisis and Europe's subsequent debt crisis. The EU itself set aside $5.28 billion for restorations in the 2014 to 2020 financial budget. Individual EU states also spend money on repairs. But as state financing dries up, governments are increasingly looking for private donors to keep up
historic structures. In recent years, Todd's Luxury Shoes provided money for repairs at Italy's Colosseum. Fendi Fashion House helped the Trevi Fountain in Rome, and Diesel backed improvements for the Rialto Bridge in Venice. We do need to invest more, but this is a shared responsibility for governments, businesses, and citizens across Europe, said the EU's Tibor Navracsics.
Some say world-renowned monuments like Notre Dame are the driving force behind tourism and should get more respect. Kvadvilig Mihailovic noted the importance of such respect. Cultural heritage is a gold mine. You cannot exploit it and then just leave the mine and go to another one. It is something you really have to cherish, she said. I'm John Russell.
And I'm Alice Bryant.
Student loan debt in the United States is over $1.56 trillion, the highest it has ever been. About 45 million Americans have debt from attending a college or university. Two-thirds of students who graduated in 2017 left school with loans averaging $28,650, according to the Institute for College Access and Success. One lawmaker seeking the 2020 Democratic presidential nomination has proposed canceling billions of dollars of that student loan debt. Elizabeth Warren is a senator from the state of Massachusetts. This week, she announced her college debt forgiveness plan. Her plan would cancel $50,000 in student loan debt for anyone whose yearly household earnings are under $100,000. Such a proposal would affect 42 million Americans. Her plan also would cancel some debt for those who earn between $100,000 and $250,000 each year. Warren describes student loan debt as a crisis for the country. She said canceling student loan debt for millions of Americans would help close the country's racial and wealth gap. Warren also proposes making all 2- and 4-year public colleges free. She says her debt cancellation program and her universal free college plan would cost the federal government a total of $1.25 trillion over 10 years. Warren says that money could come from a so-called ultra-millionaire tax. This would involve a 2% yearly tax on American families with a total wealth in dollars and a 1% tax on those with a total wealth of more than $1 billion. Warren wrote about her proposals Monday on the website Medium. She wrote, "The enormous student debt burden weighing down our economy isn't the result of laziness or irresponsibility. It's the result of a government that has consistently put the interests of the wealthy and well-connected over the interests of working families." Warren is one of more than 20 Democrats competing for their party's 2020 nomination. She has sought to set herself apart by offering several expansive policy proposals. Education has been a central topic for other Democratic presidential candidates, too. Kamala Harris, a California senator, released a plan that would give school teachers a 25% pay raise. Low pay has been blamed as one reason for the country's worsening teacher shortage. Warren, Harris, and several other Democrats running for president are backing the 2019 Debt-Free College Act. The bill would cover all costs for students attending in-state public colleges. The Democratic proposal stands in contrast to recent education-related proposals from the Republican administration of President Donald Trump. Last month, the administration proposed several changes to the ways Americans pay back their student loans. The changes were included in proposed reforms to the National Higher Education Act. The changes included canceling the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program. The program forgives federal student loans for some people who work full-time for a given amount of time in federal, state, or local public service positions. The change would only affect students who borrow money after July 1, 2020. Other changes include ending the subsidized student loans program in order to save the government money. Under that program, the U.S. Department of Education pays the interest on student loans while borrowers are still in school. The administration has proposed similar changes in earlier budget plans. The U.S. Congress, however, has voted against them.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. After the end of World War I, President Woodrow Wilson sought national support for his idea of a League of Nations. He took his appeal directly to the American people in the summer of 1919. Tony Riggs and Frank Oliver continue the story of Wilson's campaign.
The plan for the League of Nations was part of the peace treaty that ended World War I. By law, the United States Senate would have to vote on the treaty. President Wilson believed the Senate would have to approve it if the American people demanded it. So he went to the people for support. For almost a month, Wilson traveled across America. He stopped in many places to speak about the need for the League of Nations. He said the League was the only hope for world peace. It was the only way to prevent another world war. Wilson's health grew worse during the long journey across the country. He became increasingly weak and suffered from severe headaches. In Wichita, Kansas, he had a small stroke. A blood vessel burst inside his brain. He was forced to return to Washington.
For a few days, President Wilson's condition improved. Then, his wife found him lying unconscious on the floor of his bedroom in the White House. Wilson had lost all feeling in the left side of his body. He was near death. The president's advisors kept his condition secret from almost everyone. They told reporters only that Wilson was suffering from a nervous breakdown. For the next few days, the medical reports from the White House were always the same. They said Mr. Wilson's condition had not changed. People began to wonder, were they being told the truth? Some people began to believe that the president was, in fact, dead. Vice President Thomas Marshall was worried. If the president died or could not govern, then he, Marshall, would become president. But even Vice President Marshall could get no information from Wilson's doctors.
After several weeks, the president seemed to get a little stronger. He was still very weak. He could not work except to sign several bills. This simple act took most of his strength. Wilson's wife, Edith, guarded her husband closely. She alone decided who could see him. She alone decided what information he could receive. All letters and messages to Woodrow Wilson were given first to Edith Wilson. She decided if they were important enough for him to see. Most, she decided, were not. She also prevented members of the cabinet and other government officials from communicating with him directly. Mrs. Wilson's actions made many people suspect that she, not her husband, was governing the country. Some spoke of her as the nation's first woman president.
There was one issue Mrs. Wilson did discuss with her husband, the League of Nations. The Senate was completing debate on the Treaty of Versailles. That was the World War I peace agreement that contained Wilson's plan for the League. It seemed clear the Senate would reject the treaty. Too many senators feared the United States would lose some of its independence and freedom if it joined the League. The leader of Wilson's political party in the Senate, Gilbert Hitchcock, headed the administration campaign to win support for the treaty. He received Mrs. Wilson's permission to visit her husband. Hitchcock told the president the situation was hopeless. He said the Senate would not approve the treaty unless several changes were made to protect American independence. If the president accepted the changes, then the treaty might pass.
Wilson refused. He would accept no compromise. He said the treaty must be approved as written. Senator Hitchcock made one more attempt to get Wilson to reconsider. On the day the Senate planned to vote on the treaty, he went back to the White House. He told Mrs. Wilson that compromise offered the only hope for success. Mrs. Wilson went into the president's room while Hitchcock waited. She asked her husband, "Will you not accept the changes and get this thing settled?" He answered, "I cannot. Better 1,000 times to go down fighting than to surrender to dishonorable compromise."
The Senate voted. Hitchcock's fears proved correct. The treaty was defeated. The defeat ended Wilson's dream of American membership in the League of Nations. Mrs. Wilson gave the news to her husband. He was silent for a long time. Then he said, "I must get well." Woodrow Wilson was extremely sick, yet he was not the kind of man who accepted opposition or defeat easily. From his sickbed, he wrote a letter to the other members of the Democratic Party. He urged them to continue debate on the League of Nations. He said a majority of Americans wanted the treaty approved. Wilson probably was correct about this. Most Americans did approve of membership in the League of Nations. But they also wanted to be sure membership would not restrict American independence.
The Senate Foreign Relations Committee agreed to reopen discussion on the treaty. It searched yet again for a compromise. It made new efforts to get Wilson to accept some changes. But, as before, Wilson refused. He was a proud man, and he thought many of the senators were evil men trying to destroy his plan for international peace. Wilson's unwillingness to compromise helped kill the treaty once and for all. The Senate finally voted again, and the treaty was defeated by 7 votes. The treaty was dead. The United States would never enter the League of Nations. And one of the most emotional and personal stories in the making of the American nation had ended.
The long battle over the Treaty of Versailles ended with political defeat for Woodrow Wilson. Yet, history would prove him correct. Wilson had warned time and again during the debate that a terrible war would result if the world did not come together to protect the peace. 20 years later, war came. The First World War had been called the war to end all wars, but it was not. And the Second World War would be far more destructive than the first.
The debate over the Treaty of Versailles was the central issue in American politics during the end of Woodrow Wilson's administration. It also played a major part in the presidential election of 1920. Wilson himself could not be a candidate again. He was much too sick. So the Democratic Party nominated a former governor of Ohio, James Cox. Cox shared Wilson's opinion that the United States should join the League of Nations. He campaigned actively for American membership. The Republican Party chose Senator Warren Harding as its candidate for president. Harding campaigned by promising a return to what he called normal times. He said it was time for America to stop arguing about international events and start thinking about itself again.
The two presidential candidates gave the American people a clear choice in the election of 1920. On one side was Democrat James Cox. He represented the dream of Woodrow Wilson. In this dream, the world would be at peace, and America would be a world leader that would fight for the freedom and human rights of people everywhere. On the other side was Republican Warren Harding. He represented an inward-looking America. It was an America that felt it had sacrificed enough for other people. Now, it would deal with its own problems. Warren Harding won the election.
The results of the election shocked and hurt Woodrow Wilson. He could not understand why the people had turned from him and his dream of international unity and peace. But the fact was that America was entering a new period in its history. For a long time, it would turn its energy away from the world beyond its borders.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow for more stories and information from around the world. Thanks for listening. I'm Ashley Thompson.